Okay, well, let's turn to the book of Proverbs, Proverbs chapter 17. We finished 16 last week. Today we come to 17. We'll probably spend about 4 weeks on Proverbs 17. Assuming we're here this long, we'll see. It's 1 week at a time, 1 month at a time. But we could spend an entire week on really any one of these verses and any one of these chapters. They're tips of icebergs. They're verses that Solomon uses to sum up whole experiences he's had. They're verses Solomon uses to sum up situations where he's called to make a judgment, and he comes in and afterwards writes down a proverb that is the lesson that he's learned through it. There are whole worlds in each of these proverbs. And so the question that we've been answering, it has to do with the arrangement of the proverbs. We know that according to Ecclesiastes 12:9, that Solomon set these proverbs in order. He pondered, searched out, and arranged, it says, many proverbs. And so we have seen that there are indeed thematic arrangements of proverbs in each of these chapters. I call them flashes of insights. They're all flashes of insights, but then these constellations kind of come out from the background, constellations, thematic constellations of instruction. And in chapter 17, there's one overall theme that you could characterize in a number of ways. I've called it the history of iniquity. The history of iniquity. This time there are three subject groupings that you can separate out, three general themes, all of which relate to the history of iniquity in one way or another. The first grouping consists of proverbs on the tongue. And they're scattered throughout the chapter, but not just on the tongue in general, but on how the tongue is the source of so much evil. The history of iniquity, first, its source. It's unleashed by the tongue to a good degree. The second grouping deals with the incredible sweep and strength and sway of evil in the world and in our lives. And bringing all these verses together, you get this history of iniquity, second, not its source, but its force. What happens when evil is unchecked and what we're supposed to do about that. And then the last grouping deals with the inevitable punishment of the evil in the world and the discipline on evil in our own lives that God brings about. And bringing these verses together, you get the history of iniquity, third, its ultimate course, its destination, evil undone, how it's dealt with. Altogether, these three areas take up 26 proverbs, 26 of the 28 proverbs in this chapter, which give a pretty high odds that we have discovered Solomon's arrangement or some of the main things he's had in mind. So let's chart the history of iniquity, not only in the world, but in our lives, starting first this week with its source, evil unleashed, triggered to a great degree by the tongue. I'd like first to read these proverbs on this subject, and then we'll sort them out. Let's read together. Starting in verse 1, better is a dry morsel and quietness with it than a house full of feasting with strife. Strife has to do with the tongue. And then verse 4, an evil doer listens to wicked lips. A liar pays attention to the destructive tongue. Verse 5, he who mocks the poor, he's talking about your tongue, taunts his maker. He who rejoices at calamity will not go unpunished. Verse 7, excellent speech is not fitting for a fool, much less are lying lips to a prince. Verse 9, he who conceals a transgression seeks love, but he who repeats a matter separates intimate friends, and that is an evil thing. Verse 14, the beginning of strife, that is, strife with the tongue, is like letting out water, so abandon the quarrel before it breaks out. Verse 15, he who justifies the wicked and he who condemns the righteous, both of them alike, are an abomination to the Lord. That's happening today like never before. Verse 20, he who has a crooked mind finds no good, or a crooked heart, and he who is perverted in his language falls into evil. verse 27. He who restrains his words has knowledge, and he who has a cool spirit is a man of understanding. And then finally, the last verse. Even a fool, when he keeps silent, is considered wise. When he closes his lips, he is considered prudent. Now, there's one of these verses that in many ways ties them all together, so we can see the forest for the trees of what I've just read. And it's verse 20. He who is perverted in his language falls into evil. He who is perverted in his language falls into evil. He's teaching here, Solomon's teaching here, that there's a connection between how you speak and how you end up living. He who is perverted in his language falls into evil. Between what you express and what you experience. To begin with, dirty words, swearing, what's wrong with that? Perverted in language by swearing? Well, dirty words defile the spirit, and they can end up derailing a life. Because how we live starts with what we say. That's Christ's teaching in the New Testament. It seems that a lapse in language often precedes a lapse in life. It's monkey speak, monkey do. Your words are, he's saying, the warm-up for your deeds. Evil is unleashed when it's triggered by the tongue. In the history of iniquity, more often than not, maybe more than we realize, a bad tongue is the source, it's the opening move for a bad life, in little and big ways. He who is perverted in his language falls into evil. That's the umbrella, the banner that you could write over the verses that I read. So let's see how that works out through those verses. Verse 1. Better is a dry morsel and quietness with it than a house full of feasting with strife. Better is a dry morsel with quietness in it than a house full of feasting with strife. Solomon is doing a lot of things here. We could spend a whole evening on this. He's countering the assumption that the wealthier are happier. He's saying that it can be quite the opposite. Perhaps the idle rich have more time to quarrel. I don't know. Perhaps they've compromised more in their relationships to get there. A person may be really working hard to fill their house with what the world calls good. They may be burning the candle at both ends in order to have it all in the home. But the question poised here in this verse is, will it be at the cost of the home? They start to lose their marriage or their kids or their good friends, and they'll be yearning for the days when they had a dry morsel with quietness than with this house full of feasting with strife. It's a comforting verse for those who only have a dry morsel. But quietness is something to be desired. I think we've all experienced this at one time or another, when things aren't right at home and all of a sudden nothing else can give you pleasure anymore. It's not worth sacrificing it for anything, especially for money. Why does it happen? Well, many reasons, but in this proverb, the operative word is strife, which turns on, it's a Hebrew word that turns on your speech. And the main idea is that the evil unleashed by our words can wipe out all that's good in our homes. It's not worth being there. Even if you're full of wealth there. It's a paradox how immaterial words can totally destroy material things, or at least our enjoyment of them, without actually damaging them. You become a poor little rich kid. Having it all, you can be left with nothing because of the strife that's brought on by the tongue. It's like Proverbs 11:29. He who troubles his own house, whether by his words or otherwise, will inherit the wind. Just all turns into wind. And in the midst of prosperity, you'll look at all and say, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Like Solomon, a rich man, did. Why? The source of the vanity is so often the strife. That's what this verse emphasizes, the power of strife over a life. Evil unleashed that's triggered by the tongue makes life not worth living, and a home just a house. More than many realize, the real problem often is not what you're talking about, but the words that you're speaking. Or our angry words can be as much a source of the problem, the gateway for evil, as what we're angry at. Your life may be bad, but your language can make it a whole lot worse. It calls something into being. Our words are powerful because we're in the image of God. The tongue is a fire, James 3:6, as we read earlier. It creates a whole world of iniquity. Makes our world a world of iniquity. He who is perverted in his language falls into evil. Speech, strife can turn a home, no matter how full of things, into a house of cards. And so he's saying, get your priorities straight. Verse 4. An evildoer listens to wicked lips. A liar pays attention to the destructive tongue. An evil doer listens to wicked lips. A liar pays attention to the destructive tongue. The main point here is that people will tune in to what they want to hear. So often they'll find the advice that suits their flesh. If you're bent on doing evil, you'll be drawn to those who will feed that lust in your life rather than finger it. It's like it says in Proverbs 15:12, the scoffer does not love the one who reproves him. He will not go to the wise. He'll go to fools that will confirm his flesh patterns and his ways. He goes to those who approve him, but he doesn't go there just for approval. It says in this verse that he pays attention to the destructive tongue. That is, he does what it says. It's monkey hear, monkey do. So the idea is, take care who you're listening to. The wicked lips of his friends justify his behavior. They provoke his behavior. They motivate his behavior. They supply the ideas for his behavior. They do something for him and to him because they have a power over him. Such is the power of the tongue. Such is the power of what we say or what we listen to. Evil unleashed is triggered by the tongue. Verse 5. He who mocks the poor reproaches his maker. He who rejoices at calamity will not go unpunished. He who mocks the poor reproaches his maker. He who rejoices at calamity will not go unpunished. The main point here is that God is for the underdog, the one who's in calamity, the one who is poor. And so he identifies with that person, so be careful what you say about them. God is for the underdog and for the one who's being chastened by calamity, so we better keep our hands off, or maybe more to the point, we better keep our mouth shut and not judge them by what we say. That's God's business. We're to love them. Because it's not true that only sticks and stones can break their bones. God knows that our words don't just fade away harmlessly into thin air as we speak them. We, again, are in his image. So the degree to which we say something, it becomes so. This really applies to parenting and what we say to our children. But it applies in a lot of different situations. Our words have a kind of creative power in the world. In a way, we create something out of nothing when we speak. We set in motion a chain of events over which we often then have no control. It also unleashes a lot of hurt at them and can prepare the way for a lot more hurt. There's a lot more there, but we must move on. Verse 9. He who covers a transgression, and I love this verse, seeks love. But he who repeats a matter separates intimate friends. He who covers a transgression seeks love. But he who repeats a matter separates intimate friends. This means that when someone sins against you or when you see someone else sinning, it means we're not supposed to blab it all over town. We don't even whisper it in inner rooms. We hold our cards very close to our chest. Though, of course, we are under obligation to talk to them about it, to speak the truth in love. But to them and not to other people. He who covers a transgression seeks love, but he who repeats a matter separates intimate friends. This is one of the all-time great proverbs. It reminds me of a man who I buried 30-some years ago, a great and godly man named Charles Towery, a great Houstonian who lived in the country. He was a man who was not prone to repeat a matter. He incarnated this proverb. No one could remember him speaking ill against anyone. Characterized his whole life. It's a noble thing to see. I learned that from him. It's a noble thing to do. That kind of discretion is a noble thing. It's almost of a bygone era when a man's word was not spoken or taken lightly. This dignified silence that holds the knowledge of transgression as almost a sacred trust. And you lift it up in prayer, but you dare not speak about it to anyone else. It's the mark of a true gentleman, and the presence of such a man or a woman is a rebuke on the loose lips that surround us. And their absence, I learned through Charles Towery, is a great loss. It's a silence that's noticed. It's the essence of being faithful and true. The real test of your loyalty to a friend comes when you're behind their back. Because where your mouth is, there your heart will be also, towards whoever you're talking about. Someone said a true friend is someone who goes around saying nice things about you behind your back. That's the opposite. There's a nobility to that kind of loyalty. Who covers a transgression seeks love. The truest test of love for anyone, whether a close friend or just an acquaintance or your spouse or your boss or a pastor or an elder, the test of your obedience to the second great commandment that you love your neighbor as yourself, one of the acid tests is what you do with what you know, how you handle insider information. Because in God's economy, it's usually illegal to trade on that information. Like we sang, though I may speak with bravest fire and have not love, my words are vain, as sounding brass and hopeless gain. Such words sound like brass. He who covers a transgression seeks love, but he who repeats a matter separates intimate friends. Which gets us back to our main point, the evil unleashed by a tongue. He who repeats a matter separates intimate friends. More than anything else, sin separates man from God, and more than anything else, sinful speech, gossip, separates man from man, especially in the church. If you don't cover a transgression, you could end up cratering a relationship or a reputation or even the person or even a congregation. Gossip is one of the main issues in congregations. If we don't cover the transgression, our spirit will darken against the person we're talking about. Not to mention those who are listening. The words of a whisperer are like dainty morsels, Proverbs 18:8. They go down to the innermost parts of the body, and you digest them, and they become part of who you are. Beware. Such words pollute your heart of hearts. They defile you against those being whispered about. Cold words, someone said, make men cold. Especially when you're doing the whispering. This is what happens to you. Cold words make men cold. Spiteful words make men spiteful. Both the speaker and the hearer. But kind words produce their own image on our souls. Words are powerful. Words are so easy that we don't realize how deadly they are. Not only do they poison our spirits, they spread a poison like a poison gas that you can't retrieve. Verse 14. The beginning of strife, this is very applicable to marriage and other things, is like letting out water. So abandon the quarrel before it breaks out. The beginning of strife is like letting out water, so abandon the quarrel before it breaks out. That is, put your finger in the dike and keep it there before it's too late. Put your hand on your mouth, lest the relationship be swept away by the ensuing flood that can so easily happen, especially in intimate relationships. This verse applies to minor spats and to, you know, major fights. Some couples are always bickering back and forth. If it's not one thing, it's another. And true, in a way, it is no, it's no big deal. It's not like a divorce. But this verse teaches us that it's a little leak that can be that can grow into a dangerous thing. To begin with, such words have power to weaken you physically. A recent medical study of 180 newlyweds showed that constant bickering, sarcasm, and put-downs can result in elevated blood pressure and weakened immune systems. Oh, the evil unleashed by the tongue. But of course, constant bickering can weaken you maritally too, contrary to what many say. Most marriage counselors emphasize, or they have, that couples should learn to fight fair and not worry too much about how often they argue or fight. That's not true. At least not always. You may have seen a recent study of 691 marriages that contradicts conventional wisdom. Let me read it. When it comes to keeping a relationship intact, particularly after the first decade of marriage, how often a couple fights is more important than how they fight. When a number of arguments increases, no matter how calm and rational they may be, it is a sign of a higher probability of divorce. Chronic marital conflict is distressing. And at some point, one more argument becomes the straw that breaks the camel's back. The dam will give way eventually if you don't plug the little holes. There are too many of them. The beginning of strife is like letting out water, so abandon the quarrel before it breaks up. This applies to little spats and to major arguments. Not that a major argument is all bad. Interestingly, the study also found that couples who had been married the longest fought the least, but when they did fight, it got pretty heated. Stuff builds up in any relationship, especially in marriage. We've got the flesh, and it will build up. And so things will come out in heated fights. And we need to talk about it. And it's not that we should never wrestle with issues as couples. Of course we need to, and when you do, some can take it very real and very direct. That kind of honesty, though, is what makes for strong marriages when you do it in the right way. But there are times, and you only know when those times are, there are certain times when you better just arbitrarily cut it off, or you'll say something you'll really regret. And this applies to any kind of relationship. Just call it a truce before there's, you know, mutual assured destruction. Been there, done that. We're not going to do that again. We call them our black hole arguments, where there's no escape once you're in. They're tar baby arguments, where there's no getting free of them. And you can kind of see it coming. You learn over the years, hopefully. Spiritual warfare arguments, really, they are in a lot of ways. Angry words can give the devil an opportunity, especially when they escalate. Paul says that in Ephesians 5. Don't give the devil a place. They can open the door to wicked spirits. We can't be possessed by wicked spirits, but Christians can be oppressed by them, and relationships can be too, if you give the devil a place, like Paul says in Ephesians 3. And you either feed those spirits or starve them, so often by what you're serving up with your mouth. And that happens in a church too. Our anger can unleash that kind of evil if we persist in expressing it. So you learn after a while that, like Solomon says in Ecclesiastes 3:10, there's a time to be silent. It's the lesser of the evils. And that's not wrong. It's life. It's warfare strategy. 3, count to 10, back off, pray about it, and then come back or whatever. It's warfare strategy. As long as you don't forget about the other half of the verse, that there's also a time to speak. Silence is another noble deed in an ignoble day. It's a noble thing to abandon a quarrel before it breaks out. Oh, that they would learn that in Washington. Keeping away from strife is an honor for a man. We've gotten far from that in our political offices. Keeping away from strife is an honor for a man, Proverbs 20, verse 3. But any fool will quarrel. And it unleashes untold evil into the world, especially when it comes from high places. It's honorable to say in our own lives, well, I could be wrong, when you know you're not wrong, or at least you think you know. It's honorable to say, hun, the spirit's not good between us right now, but how about if we just pray and drop it for a while? It's honorable to say, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have gotten angry, when you know they were the ones that started it. Or so you think. These are honorable things to say, to abandon a quarrel. Any fool will quarrel. Literally, that reads, any fool will burst out. That's a powerful image, like a flood of water, like a leak in a dike. Evil unleashed is triggered by the tongue. Yet another way in this verse. Verse 15. He who justifies the wicked and he who condemns the righteous, both of them alike are an abomination to the Lord. He who justifies the wicked and he who condemns the righteous, both of them alike are an abomination to the Lord. Reminds me of Proverbs 24:24. He who says to the wicked, you are righteous, peoples will curse him, nations will abhor him. Unfortunately, in our day, that's not happening. Evil is being called good and good is being called evil. And untold evil is being unleashed into the word by the act of saying such things. It matters what you say. It matters what we call things. Naming things is a powerful faculty of the divine image in which we are created. And it impacts the nature of things, or at least how they're perceived. And that's why God says, woe to those who call evil good and good evil. Isaiah 50, verse 20. Because to do so unleashes great wickedness in the land. A nation that justifies the wicked with its words ends up multiplying wickedness by its deeds. Our words create a petri dish, a context, an environment in which good or bad can grow. They're the leading edge of those things. You call it an alternative lifestyle, you end up with AIDS. You encourage bad behavior. You call it a piece of tissue, like in the mother's womb, as they do with a woman in crisis, like the yolk of an egg, you end up with a lot of abortion. You call criminals victimized by society, and society ends up being victimized by criminals. Alexander Solzhenitsyn said, the defense of individual rights has progressed to the degree to leave society defenseless against the individual. These words are abominations to speak what is not right, to name it what it is not, to justify the wicked. There's so much more here, but I'm going to have to skip over something because our time is almost up. Now, this principle, we've seen several verses that relate, but let's take a step back and look at the biblical, what the rest of Scripture teaches about this principle. This principle crisscrosses the Scripture. We've alluded to it as reflected in these verses, and now it's time to focus on it, and that is this. The history, in the history of iniquity, the source of iniquity is almost inevitably the tongue. That's where the iniquity is birthed into the world from the heart, and then it goes into the deeds. It's where lust first sees the light of day. The mouth is where a miracle takes place, where thoughts that are invisible are called into being. From the inner mind into the outer world. From the spiritual into the physical. When the unseen is sounded, it is so powerful. No one has seen God at any time except through the Son. We know that through the Word of God. That explains them. And no one has seen the human heart at any time except through the things that proceed out of the mouth. Through the Word of man. They come from the heart. Those defile the man. Such things, Christ said, such things set on fire the course of the world, James 3:6. Through the word of God, the world was created, and it was very good. Just as we sang, this is my Father's world. And it's also very good and beautiful because His Word is good from where it comes. And now more than ever, through the words of those created in His image, the world is being destroyed because it is very evil. Those words are evil. As James says, the tongue is the very fire, the very world of iniquity. You've heard it said that art imitates life. But did you know that life imitates language? Life follows language. The tongue is the bit that directs the entire body, in James' words. The rudder that steers the great ship. James 3, 3 and 4. If we could catalog all our words over the years, whether angry or loving, whether pessimistic or optimistic, whether vengeful or forgiving, whether complaining or grateful, or some combination of those, as they always are. If you could catalog all our words over the years, if you took the mean average, you would have a pretty good measure of the course of that person's life. And so Solomon says, he who guards his mouth preserves his life. Proverbs 13:3. A fool's mouth is his ruin. His lips are the snare of his soul. Proverbs 18:7. Back to the main proverb for today. He who is perverted in his language falls into evil. Because in the history of iniquity, that is generally its source. It's the main access of evil into the world. Evil unleashed is triggered by the tongue. No wonder Solomon concludes it all in verse 27. He who restrains his word has knowledge. Doesn't that make you want to restrain your words? And he who has a cool spirit is a man of understanding.